This message comes from NPR sponsor Mattress Firm. Do you get the quality sleep you need? Mattress Firm will find you the right bed for your best rest with their wide selection of quality mattresses at every price. Get matched at Mattress Firm's Memorial Day sale. Sleep at night.
A warning, this episode contains discussion of sex. The series Fellow Travelers chronicles the passionate and complicated relationship between two gay men from the McCarthy era of the 1950s through the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. Over that time, the two men, played by Matthew Bomer and Jonathan Bailey, follow opposite paths. One marries and has kids for the sake of his career. The other dedicates himself to living openly and becomes a protester, an activist. In the meantime, they have lots and lots and lots of sex. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Fellow Travelers on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
I'm Rachel Martin. After hosting Morning Edition for years, I know that the news can wear you down. So we made a new podcast called Wild Card, where a special deck of cards and a whole bunch of fascinating guests help us sort out what makes life meaningful. It's part game show, part existential deep dive, and it is seriously fun. Join me on Wild Card, wherever you get your podcasts. Only from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
A former president found guilty while running for re-election. For a story this big, one podcast is not enough. Here at NPR, we've got you covered from every angle. You can get the news as it happens and legal analysis on the podcast Trump's Trials. And for all the latest on what it means for the 2024 election, head on over to the NPR Politics Podcast. Find Trump's Trials and the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the indicator of our guys in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news like...
How does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to the indicator from Planet Money and NPR.
Joining me today is NPR film critic Bob Mondello. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Glenn. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Fellow Travelers begins in Washington, D.C. during the era of Senator Joseph McCarthy's crusade against communists and homosexuals in the federal government. Matthew Bomer plays Hawkins, or Hawk, a handsome, swaggering State Department official who hides an active gay sex life even as he courts and ultimately marries the daughter of a powerful senator. She's played by Allison Williams. Jonathan Bailey plays Tim, a gay man who works for McCarthy. He believes in McCarthy's cause and struggles with his devout Catholic faith, even as he falls madly in love with Hawk.
I committed mortal sins for you.
Oh, here we go.
I could go to hell.
Hell's a fantasy, Skippy. So's heaven. The Trinity, democracy, and the holy war against communism. Grand ideas that just get people killed. Now,
the series is about the tension between the two men, both sexual and ideological. Hawk is perfectly content to stay in the closet and live a lie if it means he can hold on to his position. Tim wants more, and as the years pass, the two men keep coming back together, only to find the power dynamic between them shifting back and forth. The series is told largely in flashback as a middle-aged Hawk reflects on his relationship with Tim, who is now dying of AIDS. Fellow Travelers is based on a 2007 novel by Thomas Mallon. It was created for television by Ron Nisewaner, who wrote the films Philadelphia and My Policeman. The series is airing weekly on Showtime and streaming on Paramount Plus. You figure that out. I can't be bothered. Bob, it is so cool to have you talking about television for us. Have we ever done that before with you?
Well, I thought you were having me on solely because I'm old enough to have actually remembered a lot of this.
I mean, it's a factor.
You're right, because I don't usually think that television series deserve to be series. I'm used to thinking in terms of 2.5 hours for a movie and 3.5 if you're Martin Scorsese and you're doing it. But basically, you can fit the whole plot of a novel into that. And why on heaven's name would you want to deal with it on a longer term? And oh my God, this makes sense.
All right. Tell me why.
Well, partly because you're dealing with 4 decades of material and a whole bunch of characters. It's not just a couple of characters who pop in and out. There were places where I was thinking, okay, you could maybe do without this part. But not a lot. And the complexity of how things are changing over the four decades is what makes this so compelling. Angels in America is the same material in a way, right? It's also talking about Roy Cohn and about AIDS. It takes you all the way through. And it does it very, very differently. And I was thinking of this as sort of the melodrama version.
Interesting.
But I think it's complex enough that you'd have trouble compressing it. You'd lose a lot if you compressed it. There's the characters have real character arcs. There are big changes in them across decades. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd lose a lot.
Yeah, that's interesting because all of that, we'll get to this, but all of that is an addition of the show. The novel focused on these two characters in the 1950s.
Oh.
The show is doing a lot of this heavy lifting you're talking about. But let's start off by talking about the chemistry between Bomer and Bailey, by which I mean, let's talk about sex, baby. I mean, the phrase I kept coming back to, Bob, was insultingly attractive actors.
Yeah.
I mean, every time they take off their shirt, you're like, just shut up. And I've said before that Bomer especially is a hot basilisk. You can't look him directly in the face because of that. There's that much facial symmetry. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, he reminds you of Don Draper all the way through the thing. I mean,
sure.
You can't take that off of the table there. And Bailey is, I mean, you know, having seen him in whatever the, with Ruffles in Bridgerton.
Bridgerton, yes, yes.
It had no connection for me with reality, right? I'm looking at him and I think, well, he's a good looking kid. But other than that, I didn't have any real reaction. In this, I'm looking at somebody who is attired in the way that people were attired in the 1950s. Therefore, these were the older teens and early 20s guys that I looked up to and lusted after when I was 12. I would have followed him anywhere.
Yeah.
They're incredibly gorgeous. And I was reading, I think it was in the Times, the New York Times, when they were contemplating how to do the sex in here, they wanted never to repeat themselves.
Exactly.
And always to be talking about power dynamics so that every time you see them, something is changing. And they did that pretty well. They left relatively few things off the table.
I mean, let's be real, though. I mean, this body fat percentage did not exist in the era of three martini lunches and beef stroganoff. I don't buy it for a second. And it's funny how they strive to get everything else, all the historical detail, correct. I also like that they introduce some light kink into the sex without tut-tutting about it, with just saying, like, this is all playful. But my favorite thing about the show is how it captures the danger of being gay back then, of living in the shadows and speaking in codes and whispers and trying to find a place just to get together is a big hassle. And you see, one thing it also establishes is that being gay, just being gay, was actually being part of a criminal enterprise because these gay bars back then were run by the mob. The cops got paid off to keep people's names out of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the author of the book, Thomas Mallon, is an author of historical fiction who is famous for getting the details right. He does a crazy amount of research. The show was filmed in Toronto, so that one federal-style building in Toronto is getting a lot of work out.
I spent half of the 8 episodes trying to figure out where the hell is that building. I know it has to be down near the district courthouse, and it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I did a fellow traveler's walking tour of D.C., so the Cozy Corner, which they go to, is on Florida Avenue.
It was
it's now a Korean barbecue joint.
Uh-huh.
The Chicken Hut was an actual gay bar just off Lafayette Square. It's now a parking garage. It closed in the 70s. Do you ever find yourself at the Chicken Hut, Bob?
I did not find myself at the Chicken Hut. That was a little bit before I came out, but I know of it.
Yeah.
I knew about all those places. As a gay kid, you are conscious of them. Mm-hmm. In ways you probably wouldn't be otherwise. And yeah, they were there and there was no question about it. And I remember the fear. I remember I had an uncle who was gay who came to visit us on occasion. And, you know, he would wander around town and I worried about him.
I mean, this is the thing that I couldn't put my finger on in the show, frankly, Bob, is I did detect something in the show's depiction of McCarthy and Cohn. This notion that McCarthy's crusade was justified somehow, but he just went about it in the wrong way. He alleged vast conspiracies. He claimed he had a list of 205 communists. He didn't. He made all that up. He destroyed careers and lives. And I'm getting a sense that this guy's methods were wrong, but his crusade was right. Did you pick up on that in the show?
Well, I was distressed about it because that is the attitude that Tim takes to his boss, McCarthy. And it's wrong, but it is consistent with the way a lot of people felt about him. And I think if you were a real conservative person back in the 1950s, you thought he was doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Things changed for enough people that he was no longer able to do what he'd been doing.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, at the time Mallon wrote this book, he was a gay Republican. He's not anymore. I mean, He's left the Republican Party in 2016. Probably still gay. But that's what I'm picking up on here is just a sense of not wanting to commit to the monstrosity of this and creating a culture of fear. I think this show really does create the culture of fear. But I think you also sense something else going on because the book, as I say, stays focused on Hawk and Tim in the 50s. The show adds the characters of Marcus, who is a black reporter played by Jelani Aladdin, and Frankie, the drag performer played by Noah J. Ricketts. It also attempts to give Hawk's wife Lucy, played by Allison Williams, if not an inner life, then more to do than she gets in the book. Any thoughts on those performances?
The acting in all those cases is quite nice. I especially liked Frankie.
Yeah.
A terrific and brave and strong character. What was interesting in this is that the guys who would normally be called tops usually were the ones who were one way or another terrified, right? Who were going through life terrified by everything that was out there. And I thought that was just an interesting observation. I don't usually like television series, but this one felt like it was doing something substantial. And I can't imagine this as a film. I don't think it would work as well as a film.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine the novel strictly adapted as a film because, I mean, this also, the show brings in the time element. It brings in the anti-war movement of the 60s, the hedonism of the 70s, a very fun series of Fire Island scenes. And if you know the book, you can feel the show straining to widen out and then ultimately become kind of a chronicle of the queer rights movement.
I
think the show understands. Help me out if it doesn't. But, like, I think the show understands that the stakes for these characters are high, but that can't be the only lens that we look at the fight for queer rights through. Because these guys, Tim and Hawk, could hide inside a white male power structure very easily, the way others who were at the forefront of the queer movement at the time, people of color, trans folks, lesbians, just couldn't. They couldn't afford, they didn't have that luxury. And as a show, I kept feeling that this show wanted to be a true ensemble piece, but was still hamstrung by that original storyline. What'd you feel?
I hear what you're saying about it straining. I didn't feel that. I thought it worked as a unified whole.
Okay. That's good. Because that's clearly the intent. The intent is to bring in more voices. I felt like we could have heard more from some of those other voices. But also, let's talk about the way this show's character arcs, because there is a thing that happens in shows that attempt to depict the passage of time as broadly as this does, and that has to do with exposition, right? So you have to place these characters in context, in the era that they're in, and depict or somehow show how the major events are shaping them. And you can do that in a bunch of different ways. You can do that with title cards. You can do it in newscasts, which I always think is a cop-out.
Yeah.
Or you can do it by shoving those big events into the mouths of your characters in a very stiff and clunky way. And I think this opts for that last option again and again and again. And that is the biggest swing. And as it turns into specifically an AIDS narrative, it falls victim to what a lot of AIDS narratives pitfall to, which is you have your characters start spouting statistics and policy initiatives instead of human dialogue. But again and again, I noticed it happening, but I couldn't get mad at it because those statistics and those policy initiatives are what these characters, if you've never met an activist, that's what those characters talk about. That's what they care about. So that worked for me in a way that it doesn't in a lot of other shows or movie series like this.
You know, you talked earlier about how well-researched things are, and I'm going to guess that the television people were doing their research a little bit less well.
Okay.
Because this is me as a Broadway nut. At some point, Mr. McCarthy says he's going to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Well, Oklahoma had closed by the time he started doing the anti-communist stuff in the Senate. And so, I mean, it had been closed for a couple of years. He should have been saying guys and dolls. Those kinds of little things are stupid and will matter only to, you know, the gay guys who are watching this, maybe, who are Broadway queens. But isn't that half the audience? So anyway, I have trouble with it.
One would think. I think the other thing this show does is reveal kind of a grim truth, which was there were a hell of a lot more Hawks than Tims back then and perhaps now. And if it weren't for activists like Tim who pushed for more, maybe nothing would have changed.
Yes and no. I think the existence of HIV changed the world for gay people generally. It's a horrific thing to say, but it is what allowed gay rights to advance in this country, because basically all of us came out of the closet at once. You just couldn't avoid it. You had to help your friends. You had to help yourself. You had to, it was suddenly there. Tim is a character who is saintly, right? I mean, at one point, I think he's actually referred to as Saint Tim, right? I think that they make clear what I was saying earlier, that the guys who are, who we would all refer to as tops today, the ones who are strong and dominant in life, were the ones who were most closeted because they had the most to lose by losing that dominance.
And I think, to your point, Bob, they do address that, this notion of everybody coming out at once. It does become an element of the series at the very end, which we can't go into.
I kind of want to say to anybody who sees this that if you know an elder gay out there, talk to them about this. This was a profound time in American life and in gay life in America. Profound. And the people who lived it are disappearing.
Bob, I appreciate that. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We want to know what you think about Fellow Travelers. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. This episode was produced by Ramel Wood and edited by Jessica Reedy and Mike Katzeff. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
When you hear Birmingham, Alabama, you might think about the Civil Rights Movement, but maybe not about baseball. But as the oldest pro ballpark in America, Rickwood Field saw the struggle for freedom play out right there on the dirt and grass. I'm Roy Wood Jr. I grew up in Birmingham, and I'm going to tell you this whole story. Listen to Road to Rickwood from WWNO and WRKF, part of the NPR network.
When the economic news gets to be a bit much,
listen to The Indicator from Planet Money. We're here for you, like your friends, trying to figure out all the most confusing parts. One story, one idea, every day, all in 10 minutes or less.
The Indicator from Planet Money, your friendly economic sidekick.
From NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me isn't just jokes about the week's news. It's also life hacks. For example, here's actor Karen Allen revealing how she got her starring role in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
They said, how well can you spit? And I just found it coming out of my mouth. I said, oh, I can hawk him with the best.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you want to increase your self-confidence, then listen to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
Every weekday, NPR's best political reporters come to you on the NPR Politics Podcast to explain the big news coming out of Washington, the campaign trail, and beyond. We don't just want to tell you what happened, we tell you why it matters. Join the NPR Politics Podcast every single afternoon to understand the world through political eyes.